stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 million suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full beyond measure. Elegant truths of exquisite interrelation.
Life is a beautiful struggle. Found the way, but almost lost my step. Yes, found the way, but almost lost my step.
This is what the album needs.
Smoke. Better call Smokey the Bear, cause I'm the rarest showpiece. Listen closely, I'm the most sickest rapper. In your 016 chapel, I have blown through some chapters. But I won't regret after, I am done with my rapture. I am done with the laughter, I'm the sun, can't be captured. And a smash bit in a massacre, half of us want the real shit. But we are forced fed all of this horseshit, it's unfortunate. It is unfair, that's why I'm never done here. I love how I'm rebuilding and the future, it is unclear. Hey, popping off and shooting bottle rockets. I'm a throttle rocker, never sitting idle.
When the sun rays bright, rise and shine, early wakers. Got a part-time apartment in the land of the Lakers. Overrated by some, underrated by most. We orchestrated what no one has ever done for my coach. Before I put the fire out, putting fighters out their misery. That's another Spider-Man and Silver Surfer mystery. Delivering my system of belief is a must. Believing family and friends is only few you can trust. The three of us, we stuck together through the thick and the thin. And now we've got some thicker skin, but still predicted to win. You either sink or you swim, you either float or you drown. So don't slow down, throw down, and own your crown. Because I
to understand more about fashion, we asked CITR student executive and fashion expert Jonathan Q what fashion means to him.
Like, it's just aesthetically something that's so ostentatious. Typically. I mean, because of course, I mean, it's also, you know, I mean, when you say fashion, I think people are talking explicitly about consumerism, as opposed to someone who buys, like, you know, all the clothes. Let's say, you know, someone buys a
If you really want to know more about fashion, come on down to CITR in the Student Union Building of UBC and pick up some of our merchandise à la mode. Nous avons t-shirts, sweatshirts, socks, and coffee mugs.
But it's also very aesthetically gripping.
To keep you styling in support of the station you love. Isn't that right, Jonathan?
Well, actually, is it? Because, I mean, you know, I was going to say because of the cultural vacuum that we exist within, but then, you know, really, fashion today is kind of derived from the European idea of couture, and that's been around for centuries.
My address is 294 Salisbury Street.
I can't understand you. You need to speak English.
Hey, Polly, that remark is totally inappropriate. I know you're new here, but this is a safe harbor office. We're committed to treating all of our clients respectfully.
What would you do if you were this witness? Safe Harbor Respect for All provides diversity workshops across Canada with funding from the Government of Canada. Visit safeharbor.ca. Respect for all. Pass it on.
Hey, this is Textbook CITR 101.9 FM. We broadcast from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Hunkamina-speaking Musqueam people. My name is Josh. I'm your host for this program. It is a program about textbook and not-so-textbook approaches to student life. Today, I'm in the studio with Claire Bailey. Claire, hello.
Hello.
What's going on? How are you?
I'm well.
Claire, you've ditched class early to come here, which is not the first time this has happened on the show. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourselves? What are you studying?
Well, I'm in third year. I'm majoring in English Lit and minoring in Visual Art.
You are the Discorder exec at the station?
Yeah, the Discorder liaison.
Discorder liaison. I've also done this job before. It's a good one. And you have a story for us today.
I do.
And this story starts when you are downloading an audiobook.
Yes. I was trying to download Our Mutual Friend by Charles Dickens so that I could listen to it as I was going on a walk without internet. And it was a bit of a hassle.
Audiobooks can be.
They can be, yeah. So I was planning to go for a walk in Pacific Spirit Park because I thought it was a great way to get some reading done while doing some exercise, getting fresh air. But it was sort of the middle of winter. Days were getting shorter. And so the hassle of downloading this audiobook meant that I went out for my walk kind of later than normal. So it was starting to get dark.
And where were you going to go walk?
I was going to walk in Pacific Spirit Park, the part that's like north of 16th.
Oh, north of
16th. I mean south. South.
South of 16th. Okay, yeah. Yeah. Right. Okay, so this is like, these are like trails.
Yeah.
These are like pretty deep woods trails.
Yeah. I was planning to just do like this shallow little loop that I always do, but because I was like focusing on Our Mutual Friend, I like wasn't really paying attention where I was going. And so, yeah.
You're walking.
I'm walking.
It's dark.
It's starting to get dark. And I'm starting to like realize that I don't really know where I'm going. And then the audiobook stops because I don't have internet and like, I guess it didn't download properly. And so it's like all quiet and it's like getting pretty dark and I'm starting to get a little bit spooked, but I'm like, soon this path is just going to curve around. It's going to be where I normally go. And everything's going to be fine.
And what happened next?
And then I see this white thing swoop over the path in front of me. And I'm like, whoa, what was that ghosty thing? And I think like maybe it was definitely some kind of bird. It was a really big bird. And I think like maybe it was an owl. And part of me was like, whoa, it was like really cool. And the other part of me was like, oh my gosh, big bird is swooping over the path and it's really dark and
did
I really don't know where I am.
Did it feel like it was attacking you?
Not yet. At that time I thought like, ooh, maybe I'm in its territory and it's like trying to scare me. But at that, when I first saw it, I just thought it was like kind of cool and it'd be a great thing to tell my roommates about later. And then, so I just like keep walking. Still like not really knowing where I am going and it's very quiet because my audiobook has crapped out on me. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden I feel these like sharp hands grab the back of my head really tightly and I just like scream and bend down and like grab my head.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that this bird, this big bird, this owl, has grabbed, like, the hat off my head and it dropped it so that I still had it. But, like,
that's very
terrifying.
Threatening of the owl, too.
So scary. Its claws were really sharp. Like, if I hadn't been wearing my hat, it would have cut me, I think.
Gnarly.
Yeah.
Fun and terror.
Yeah.
On UBC
and so,
campus.
Yeah, after that, I was just really freaked out and I like had screamed really loud too. Mm-hmm. And I like eventually like find a map and realize I have to like go back through bird territory to mm-hmm. get home. And I like just want to see someone to like feel assured that, I mean, you hear horrible stories about Pacific Spirit Park in the dark too.
Right.
So I'm like, I gotta get out of here. And I like went by these two dog walkers and thought about being like, can I walk home with you? But I didn't. I just, like, ran. I
got
ran
out of there.
I got out of there.
I like that story a lot because owls attacking humans on a university campus feels sort of ironic.
Yeah.
It feels like
attack of the wisdom.
Attack of wisdom on UBC.
Mm-hmm.
Attack of the textbook owl on UBC. That is a freaky story. And then the rest of your night, how was it?
It was pretty good. I felt kind of, I could like still feel the feeling of like the claws on my head.
Oh God, creepy.
But
you bounced back.
I bounced back. I had an exciting story to tell after that.
Great.
Much more exciting than just the swooping owl.
Yeah. Great. Thank you so much, Claire.
Thank you
Claire
for
Bailey
having me.
Is the Discorder liaison. She's also a third-year English and visual arts student. On the show today, we have an interview with Dr. Annette Henry, who is a professor here. This is for the Black History Month. February is Black History Month, and at CITR, we like to celebrate that with some good radio content. So that's coming up next, interview with Dr. Henry. Here it is. Thanks so much for listening. Textbook CITR 101.9 FM. February is Black History Month in Canada. CITR 101.9 FM hopes to do its part in celebrating Black history while aiming for more consistent and even representation of experiences often missing from the media narrative. To talk about how to make Black History Month beyond the month of February, we sat down with Dr. Annette Henry. Dr. Henry is a David Lamb Chair in Multicultural Education and is a professor at the Department of Language and Literacy Education at UBC. Her scholarly research investigates race, class, language, gender, and culture in sociocultural contexts of teaching and learning, particularly in the lives of Black students and Black women teachers. Her research scope includes Canada, the U.S., and the Caribbean. And her focus also includes feminism as well as conceptual and methodological research issues. Dr. Henry, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
My pleasure.
So can you introduce your work a little bit for listeners? Tell us a little bit about your research interests.
Oh, yes. My research interests, as you read in the bio, I do qualitative research. I do narrative research. Right now I'm actually doing a big study of, so I have 90 audio tapes of life history interviews that were done about 10 years ago in Vancouver of Black people in Vancouver, and they were sitting on a shelf. So I'm working on that, and just I'm actually just digitizing them because they're on little microcassettes. But I mostly do life histories of Black women teachers. I'm very interested in what happens in classrooms with Black children in Canada and also in the U.S. and in the Caribbean, in Jamaica particularly, also, although I have worked in Haiti. And I also... I'm very interested in feminist theory, so Black feminism, and applying feminist theory to thinking about teaching and learning in classrooms.
Mm-hmm. So I guess, you know, to begin, Vancouver, like a lot of the Pacific Northwest, really has a very tenuous relationship to its own Black history. Mm-hmm. You know, there's the history of Hogan's Alley and figures like Joe Fortes, mm-hmm. Nora mm-hmm. Hendricks' tradition of Black entertainment that she was a part of. How do you doing this work now on interviews with about Black history? How do you think about Vancouver's specific Black history?
Yes, well, you know, Black history in you hit the nail on the head. Black history in Vancouver has been erased. Like it's not really celebrated, and people sort of look at me and like, huh? What are you what are you doing? But we have a rich history since the 1850s, and you know, even James Douglas, the governor, was so-called mixed, right? On Salt Spring Island and so forth, and so we don't really have the numbers, for example, that one would find in a city like Toronto or Montreal. But we do have a Black presence, but we haven't really. It's not celebrated. It's not talked about very much. And there are some people doing the work, of course, as you mentioned, people like Wade Compton and the people in the Hogan's Alley Collective, for example. And I think I'm contributing with this group of people that I'm looking at. And actually, it was a Black women's organization, the National Council of Black Women, that collected these interviews, and I think part of it was to keep the legacy going, to, you know, change the historical record, if you like, to revise the historical record. So so I think that that's my little part in Vancouver, and I think if we are a multicultural society, then we should really know about the various groups of people that live in British Columbia.
And tell me a little bit more about these interviews, if you're able to. So you procured them through this organization, and,
yeah.
And what exactly, who exactly is speaking on these interviews?
Okay, yeah. So we have people from like 28 to in their about 85 at the time. Some of them, a couple of them have since died. So some of them have been, well, people like Leon Bibb, you know, the famous folklorist and a singer, entertainer. Mm-hmm. He was one of them. So we have a lot of entertainers, actually, which I think says something about what black people at a certain point in history could do and why they came to Vancouver. Entertainers, actors, singers, surgeons, lawyers, teachers, writers, professors. So it's I would say, quote-unquote, professional people. Mm-hmm. And so... Those were the collection that was curated.
There's also something interesting about entertainment specifically as a kind of place of visibility maybe for the black community. And you've written in the past about Canada in comparison to the U.S. and Canadian universities where race is talked about. Or race, rather, isn't talked about, but diversity is made very public. I'm wondering what you think about Black History Month as a time where we talk or make certain things public.
Yeah, well, you know, it's kind of contradictory, and it's both at one and the same time, like just a wonderful, marvelous time, and a time where, you know, one has to say, you mean we only have 28 days that we can celebrate ourselves? And so, many people have made the joke before that, you know, it's the coldest month of the year and it's the shortest month of the year, so let's just give that to black people.
Right.
But given that it was meant to be transitional, that it was meant to be just a way of beginning to talk about black history, so in 1926, when it was established in the U.S. as Negro History Week, it's now Black History Month, and some people call it African Heritage Month and different names. So it's a marvelous time because there's all kinds of interesting lectures and films and spectacular events, you know, and even in the popular media, things like I just saw Hidden Figures, for example, at the theater, and James Baldwin's I Am Not Your Negro. So there's really lovely stuff out there, mm-hmm. and lectures and talks. But it would be really nice if we didn't have to squish it all into one month. This is just normalized, that, you know, that there's always amazing black films available and always amazing lectures on black life available. So that's the contradiction.
Right. And how do you think that we can kind of continue that practice into the rest of the year, the other 11 months? Where do you think, are there certain models for thinking about that, how we can continually reflect on black history?
Yes, well, I think one thing that we can do, speaking of us at a university, is I think we can hire more black professors. I think we can, you know, so that, and teach, not that only black people should be teaching about these things, but I think to change the conversation. The question is, how do we change the conversation? And I think if we have more racialized faculty, the conversations should change, so, and will change. I think that's mm-hmm. a huge thing.
Mm-hmm. In that same paper I mentioned before, which is titled "We Especially Welcome Applications from Members of Visible Minority Groups," you take up specifically a subjective analysis, a sort of history,
yeah.
of your own going through as a black professor at three different universities. And I'm wondering how you think we can integrate that kind of lived experience to our understanding of Black History Month instead of falling back on this kind of safety net of, you know, objective, hard facts.
Yeah, it's I'm glad you read that paper. I actually have been very pleased with the feedback I've gotten on that, because, you know, when you write a paper that's so subjective, you never know.
Mm-hmm.
But I think still, though, the reactions to that paper have been interesting, because I feel that it should create a dialogue amongst certain people, but it hasn't been able to, you know, and I think sometimes, you know, some people are very resistant to actually having these very nitty-gritty conversations, mm-hmm. although I have to admit that I found the students very open to the discussions, and I have hope there, because I feel that the students are going to be the next generation of professors and professionals and people out there in the world, and so, you know, they're the ones that I think we should be focusing on.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this question of lived experience is really interesting to me, and I think that that must also be applicable to these interviews, and thinking about these interviews that you're working on now.
Yeah, because very much so. I mean, I started out my first, you know, research study, and part of my PhD dissertation was looking at the life histories of five black women teachers and looking at their practices in their classroom and how their life experiences have informed their what they do in the classroom, because what they did in these classrooms with kids in, you know, I don't want to stereotype, but, you know, we have all these words like low-income, impoverished mm-hmm. area, but none of that they learned from teacher education, you know. So they learned it from their life experience, understanding students from the Caribbean, students from low-income areas, and students who speak particular kinds of Creoles and so forth. And so so I think, interestingly, our life experiences inform our practice, whatever that practice is.
Mm-hmm. What do you think Black History Month means in Canada? A country, you know, which defines itself on a particular brand of multiculturalism?
Yeah, these are great questions. Well, I think, you know, we're newer to, I guess it's about 20 years since the Honorable Jean Augustine introduced Black History Month. But I think we've embraced it, but I still feel that there are, like, something that happened quite recently. One of my colleagues had said to me, until you came here, I'd never heard of Black History Month.
Hmm.
And this is a woman in her mid-50s. I was really surprised, and then I said to myself, well, I guess she wouldn't, because she doesn't associate with any black people, and maybe the kinds of people she, you know, in her circle just mm-hmm. wouldn't be even thinking of anything like this. And so also, as you mentioned, we pride ourselves in being this multicultural society where we tend not to sort of put emphasis on any one group. So we say, but that's not exactly true, because mm-hmm. we do put emphasis basically. So you just have to, you know, look around, and the emphasis is on sort of Anglo conformity. So I think we're coming to Black History Month, and I know when I was a school teacher, and I remember another teacher, and this was years ago, who cares about Black History Month? And it was okay to say something like that then. But I think we've progressed, and people see, well, yeah, there's some important things to know, and we also have so many other months. I mean, in a sense, it's kind of crazy, you know. So we have, you know, Asian, you know, March, and Women's History Month, and this and that, and so everybody has their little months now.
Right. Right. And is that going to be the extent of multiculturalism?
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. That's kind of very, very, you know, liberal song and dance. You get your month, we'll keep you happy, mm-hmm. you know, and then you get your month, and we'll keep you happy.
Right. You've also written on Stuart Hall, who I mm-hmm. wanted to talk about briefly. Mm-hmm. Hall's written a lot about diasporic communities, and a lot of ways we can maybe think about Black History Month as a kind of time to maybe think about diaspora. And what sort of lessons do you think Stuart Hall can provide for thinking about Black History Month?
Yeah, well, Stuart Hall, I think, really understood diaspora, and he talked about the Caribbean as being the first diaspora and being the diaspora of a diaspora. So in many ways, and I suppose Pan-Africanism also gives us this sense of the interconnectedness and also understanding the specificities of, or understanding, I should say, how kind of global migrations have informed who we are and where we are in the world. So I think he's been, you know, very important in thinking about blacks in Britain and definitely migrations. And one of the things that I came to understand in my paper about Stuart Hall as an educator was that he actually was an educator, like in schools. He worked in a comprehensive school, and so he was very involved in as an activist while he was a substitute teacher. That was like something I'd never heard of before. Mm-hmm. So that sort of gave me another side to him as this amazing public intellectual and scholar, but also a real teacher in the true sense of the word.
I wanted to touch on, just before we finished up, about the black radical tradition, which has been evoked and you know, taken up quite a bit over the past few years in relation to Black Lives Matter.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think the value of studying this tradition is?
Well, I think it's important and also to see its variegations. Like, I think one of the things that's important for us as Canadians, too, is to realize that this Black radical tradition is not just American, you know, that it is, we can say it's Pan-African, we can think of David Austin's work in the, as he looked at the unrest, let's just call it, in the 1960s, you know, when the black students basically brought you know, the university to a halt, and Sir George Williams University, now called Concordia, to a halt. And so the black radical tradition has been here too. But then again, I think looking at the black radical tradition, we see a couple of things. A, not much has really changed, because we're still thinking about and asking for equity. We're still talking about the overrepresentation of black men in prison. We're still talking about the overrepresentation of kids in special education, or kids not getting the education that they need. Even in Canada, where, you know, I think we think of these things very much in sort of impoverished areas in the United States, but no, we have these issues also in Canada, where, you know, there are schools in Toronto where 40% there are 40% dropout rates, and so. In my opinion, like, the kinds of things that people have been arguing for and fighting for and dying for, you know, are still prevalent.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, looking at Black Lives Matter, it's another iteration of saying we're not there yet, and we have to be vocal, or it doesn't seem we're going to be heard.
Absolutely. Dr. Henry, thank you so much for speaking with us today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Josh. I enjoyed it. Thanks.
Now, when you were starting out as a writer, you were black, impoverished, homosexual. You must have said to yourself, gee, how disadvantaged can I get?
Well, no, I thought I hit the jackpot.
Oh, great.
It was so outrageous you could not go any further, you know. You had to find a way to use it.
Curated by Barbara Chirinos in partnership with VIF Van City Theater, the annual Black History Month film series shines a spotlight on African North American film and history. This year's program encompasses music, political protest, spiritual, emotional, enterprise, and endeavor. The centerpiece of Black History Month at Van City Theater is the exclusive Vancouver premiere of the Academy Award-nominated documentary I Am Not Your Negro, screening from February 24th. Other highlights include Julie Dash's seminal Daughters of the Dust, the music films Molly Blues and Sign of the Times, and a new Canadian documentary about the untold history of black hockey players, Soul on Ice.
Considering a master's, MBA, or doctoral degree? Mark Wednesday, March 1st in your calendar and get over to the UBC Nest for the graduate school fair. Or do you want to study, work, or volunteer abroad? Get down to the Vancouver Convention Center on Thursday, March 2nd to visit the Study and Go Abroad fair. Both events are free. Check online at studyandgoabroad.com for more info.
Luke Penny is a fourth-year environmental science student. He is on exchange from Cardiff. He also plays drums in the band Cruel Sport. And he's here today to talk about his paper for the Tell Me About Your Paper segment. Luke, thanks for coming in. Do you want to just read off the title of that paper to start?
Yeah, the title of the paper is Fayera Bend on Archaic and Classical Greek Worldviews and Their Anthropological Interpretation from Against Method.
That sounds really dense, but it's actually not that dense when you get into it.
It's not that dense. And we're not really going to talk about the paper that much. It's going to be more about this book, Against Method, and like the thoughts I've had like around the reading of the book, because the paper is interesting, but I didn't even get a very good mark, so I don't think.
So, Fayera Bend, we're both going to admit it right now. We can't really pronounce his name properly.
Yeah.
He's Austrian.
Yeah, so forgive us, please.
What was all the Austrians should forgive us for this. What was his background? Where is he coming from?
So, he was a professor at University of California, Berkeley, from, like, working in the first half of the 1900s. And he's a philosopher of science, and he really was like studying how scientific knowledge continues through time. And he really advocated an anarchic kind of view of science, and that if you stick to one methodology, which is obviously you can reduce science just to a methodology, you can't get anywhere with your conceptual change. So you use a methodology, and that results in these kind of facts, which if you are just sticking to those facts, you will not actually get anywhere, obviously. So, for instance, any conceptual change in science, you have to go against the orthodox facts, create new facts, etc. So he was saying no methodology is kind of better than another, and we should just be more open with our science. And I think that's a big problem.
And so this is this kind of idea of anarchic science.
Anarchic science.
Epistemology, right? Is that it?
Yeah, that's how he would frame it.
So this is against methods.
Yeah, so against method, exactly. So, I really just like inspired me. Well, it's really actually like just advocating ideas I previously had before I read, but it like informed me more. So for instance, if we go back to what science actually is, it's basically just posing a question, a hypothesis, and then using empirical means to answer that question. Now, that creates these kind of like truths, which are very easily called truths because you're setting it up in a conception of science, but then how does the truths apply outside that conception? And that becomes dangerous because something is clearly true, like 1 + 1 = 2, for example. You can use that truth against other human like thought modes or other conceptions to be like, no, this is the truth because we've set up the bounds of it. Like you've set up a bounds of an experiment and you can definitively say this is, or you think you can say this is wrong or right, but then obviously you actually can't say that. But the problem with science is it creates this way of kind of like masking what's really happening and creates these like false truths, which then just become like habit. A nice example of that is, for instance, I was doing two courses last term. One, they were actually on the same thing. One was a third year level, one was a fourth year level. And what I was learning in the third year level, which was presented as, both were presented as kind of this is what we think about the science. What I was learning in the fourth year level wasn't just building on what the third year level said, it was completely disproving it. Yet in the third level, in order to get the grade, I just jumped through the hoops and essentially lied. So that's just like a nice way of like showing how.
Right. So this is science course.
Yeah, science courses. Yeah.
And the idea here is that you're building this knowledge incrementally, and so in the third year course, you would learn this stuff only to have it disproven.
Yeah, but it's not just being disproven. It's just the fact that the two were running in parallel. Mm-hmm. Just is this perfect example of how the language needs to change throughout the conception. Because if I was taking the third year one as truth and not basically breaking the method, scientific method, then you've got like kind of got like no progression of science. Because obviously you could just have people holding, because essentially science, I mean, when enough people get together and decide something is correct, then it kind of becomes correct. Then you get enough people to like publish a book, and that creates these like ivory towers of like power and stuff. And that creates a truth. Whereas like in reality, like, I don't know, it's difficult.
So so the interesting thing here is that you're coming from a science background.
Yeah.
And what is it like taking these kind of courses? I mean, is this the first time that you've taken a course like this, which is on the history and philosophy of science? Is it not?
Yeah, history and philosophy of biology.
Biology. And then were you taking this kind of stuff at Cardiff or not?
No, I've never taken any philosophy courses. And it's really interesting because studying ecology and stuff especially, it does give you a really like different worldview. Because I think if you like the current, like, well, a lot of like philosophy is maybe moving to like a third worldview lately. Like a lot of people will obviously also be very against that, like Enlightenment philosophers. But then there is this move to people like Foucault and stuff who are like moving to like the post-structuralist. And for me, that's like really bound up in ecology, because in ecology you just learn so much about how there is no self-determinization. Kind of these plants are just like living where the bounds of the environment allows them to live, and they don't actually have any choice. And I think that should be applied to humans more, because obviously biologists are interesting because often the species they never turn to is the human themselves. And like Marx always advocated for scientific socialism, like why aren't we looking at like human relations more scientifically? And that brings me back to kind of science as a truth. When you're taught science in schools, it's very like science is true and, you know, this is how the world is progressing. And I think if you just reduce everything to empirical means like that, it does like reduce empathy and stuff. For instance, if you see a homeless person on the street and you could just say, oh, it's very simple why they're homeless, they haven't got enough money because they didn't work hard enough, that's quite an easy empirical answer. But then obviously in reality they didn't determine their background or where they were born or what happened to them to get them into that state. So I think when science is dangerous, because undoubtedly science produces truths, but then it's very easy to produce a truth when the question you're asking is pretty easy to answer. I mean, like, how much force do you need to push this ball up through this hole or something like that? Could be like a physics hypothesis. I mean, you could answer it pretty easily compared to a philosophical question like, what is the nature of being or something? You can't actually answer that. So science uses that to then say, oh, often, like, people who don't understand science, I believe, then use that to say, well, science is the ultimate, like, human conception. And they don't even see it as a human conception. They just see it as nature. Whereas, obviously, even nature would be completely, have a different conception in different communities. So I study environmental science, but I'd argue that First Nations people understand, like, before we colonized, would understand the environment a lot better, but they have a completely different conception about it. Like, the rivers are living and stuff, and it's like they can completely understand the environment, they can completely live with it, and they just have a completely different conception of what nature even is. Because obviously it goes back to like Descartes, like the dualism of mind and body, and the idea that we can control nature, and that's how to understand it. But I think fortunately, like, we're moving away from that. I mean, with climate change, etc., we need to take a different approach.
Right. So going back here to second to something you said, the idea in this kind of enlightenment idea, in this very scientific idea of the individual, right? Which is that the individual has this autonomy and is able to make their decisions, able to extract information and then make decisions on that. And the individual can operate and can do things unencumbered by the world around them. And then you're coming through here with this ecology background where you're seeing this stuff and seeing that the individual is always connected to everything else that's going around them.
Exactly, yeah.
And so,
even as a subject, like, there is no I without you. Like, it's kind of relative. Like, you can't make an identity even, like, going back to, like, even just, like, ideas of identity and stuff without everyone around you influencing you. And, yeah, I think ecology is a really important science because there are many different schools still of ecology, and it's one of the sciences which still isn't presented as truth because it's just so complex.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, many like people of like Foucault and like biopolitics have used, obviously it's not me coming up with this, like ecology in humans, like it's pretty common, but I think it's pretty important.
And so what is the connection here between this idea of method and this idea of how science is taught?
Well, I think it goes back to the idea of the methods stringently producing a truth. So then science, for instance, in a science class, you don't have much debate that often. I know we're told to think critically, but I don't think they really... So you're taught to think critically, for example, then you're answering a bubble sheet. So, like, you can't have any debate with a bubble sheet, right? So, like, whether or not you discuss a paper in class and you're like, yeah, science is about all this different stuff, it comes reduced down to a bubble sheet. And unfortunately, because of kind of the way we're taught in schools, it does just like reduce you to a cog. And I think we have this interesting like division of academic labor where, for example, like I've got really good at answering bubble sheets and you study English, so you're probably better at writing kind of papers and stuff. So I mean, it's just kind of interesting. I think that basically, like I said earlier, like distracts everyone from other means of doing things and just kind of like isolates you in what you're doing. And then it just like, it's a method that like reproduces the same thing because you're just like jumping through these hoops and you can just like do that forever. But I think science needs to be taught like more critically. It needs to be taught as a human conception rather than truth, rather than like nature itself. Because it does become dangerous if you think you can control everything, as we've seen with climate change, nuclear war, like all these things which science has produced.
Right, right. So you're drawing out this idea of the empathy and kind of linking it to climate change and to these kind of...
Yeah, almost. I think that's two different frames, because I think climate change is a result of science, obviously, like technological advancement to dig up coal and all this other stuff. But then also it can reduce empathy, because if you're completely scientific, you might just reduce everything to numbers, perhaps, and you're basically distracted. Like, in a Marxist sense, you're kind of like, you're alienated from like the production of your work, because science is often just like held by these journals who doesn't really go anywhere out of the scientific community. It's like, what is the what should we be doing with science? And undeniable, I'm not saying science is bad. I love science. I study science. I find it fascinating. I find the way you can get a truth is amazing, and we should be trying to understand the world. But we should also be trying to understand the limits of science and not just professing it as this great truth. And you need to ask, like, you know, science has produced all this stuff. I mean, for instance, we're speaking on the radio, but like, who is this actually benefiting? Like, you know, great benefits for whom? Kind of like what science can do, but then not disregarding any other human conception as lesser than science, because they might not be able to come with like truths, but then... I don't know, sometimes scientific truths aren't worth anything because they're only understood in one conception, i.e. science. So.
Mm-hmm. And you also, we were talking before about this kind of classical Greek, so this Aristotelian kind of idea of observing the world, which we don't see as science. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, so I guess Aristotle's biology and his work at Aristotle's Lagoon studying animals was basically entire biology until all the way through the Renaissance, and everyone would always turn to Aristotle. What did Aristotle think? And Aristotle was interesting because Plato, I guess, was almost maybe more like... Plato was always like, there's no point in studying the earth. Like, there's no truce here. Like, we must just, like, observe the heavens and what's eternal, and kind of, that's not a triangle. Like, a triangle is this perfect thing. Whereas Aristotle was the complete opposite. He wanted to look at all the differences in the world, and the truth came from like what brought all those things together, like what was all the all the triangles in nature and stuff like that. And he basically just said like, no, we need to, the truths are here on earth, they're not in the heavens. So he went out and observed, he just watched nature and just had a completely different conception of it, because he didn't set up experiments to try and control it. He just wanted to see it in like a really specific context, and he noticed many things that still could be applied in modern science, which is quite amazing. So it's just completely different to today's science, where it is a notion of control, setting up an experiment with specific bounds rather than just simple observation. Not simple observation, that's not true at all. Complex observation.
So Aristotle was working, in a sense, without method.
Yeah, without method, exactly. He was inventing a method, almost. It was just watching. Exactly. That's actually really interesting that you say that, because, yeah, he was almost working without a method. So you don't get these hard truths, you just get a different conception, but then it doesn't mean his conception was any less worthwhile, because, as I explained earlier with First Nations, their conception of nature, which we would see as completely untrue, actually has served them better than our conception of nature.
Right, and I think that there's also a link to be drawn out here with language and with language can do in terms of representing truth.
Well, exactly, yeah. And sorry, I didn't interrupt you there.
Yeah, go on.
Well, because that's exactly what Feyerabend then says. And obviously Wittgenstein and would say the limits of my world are the limits of my language. So when you have conceptual change, you basically attribute, you just talk a load of stuff and basically attribute the words to the meaning by just using them in that context. And that creates a fixed kind of reality or a world that then, in order to escape that, you need to disregard language and just, like, move on. So an example we were talking about just, like, before this conversation was LGBTQ+ community. Like, without those terms, do those people actually have political recognition in a shared space? And it's the same thing with science. It's like, imagine just coming up with the word atom or something like that. You need to completely break out of what was there before. And Ami Feyerabend says how language is only the manifestation of a conceptual change. So you have conceptual change, then you have language, then logic can understand that language. Thus, if you're looking at a different conceptual world, like an archaic, like Homer's world, you couldn't use our logic because our logic is a product of our language. So logic is very fixed because it's like, as we know, logic is completely fixed, and that's completely opposite to his anarchic view of science. So Wittgenstein is a good example. In his first book, he's like, all meaning can only come through this descriptive language, and it's got these very set rules. Then in his second book, he wrote, no, I'm completely wrong. There's clearly meaning can be conveyed in art, poetry, and stuff that just doesn't make any sense in this logic. Then it comes down to all about, like, yeah, conveying meaning. I think I've lost the plot. I'm sorry.
No. That makes sense. I mean, that's exactly it. With Wittgenstein, you have this real break. What are you hoping to do going forward with this stuff? Because, I mean, you have more, like, of your degree to do, and you have this course. And what are you hoping to do with this paper? What are you hoping to do with this kind of toolbox that's been assembled? How are you, like, looking forward?
I'm not sure. It's interesting you asked that. I think I'm doing my master's in environmental science. I'm actually looking at paleoclimate soon, which will be fascinating. But I just think I just need to, it's just allowed me to view science with a critical eye, which I have been doing for some time, but it was just like my thoughts have been manifesting. And I think I am going to hopefully go into philosophy after this, and specifically philosophy of science, I suppose. And I'm really sorry that I kind of got a bit lost and we didn't really talk about the paper that much.
No, I think we did. I think we covered a good portion of it.
It was kind of, didn't have much time. We didn't really have much time to prepare. So it was very just like, we just started having a conversation. But yeah, where am I going forward? No idea, really. I think I'm going to just finish this degree and then just keep like learning autodidactically and just keep questioning and thinking critically, I think, as we all should. I don't know.
Great.
Sorry, that's very vague.
No, that was not
this paper
at all.
Isn't really going to go anywhere. Like, I got really bad marks. I didn't answer the question, but I got the full marks for argument. So the argument was good, but I didn't actually do what they wanted me to do because it was a really interesting book. I recommend you read it. If you study science, you should read Against Method.
I think that's a great spot to finish. Luke, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Tune in every Monday from 4 to 5 p.m. for A Little Bit of Soul with your host, Jade Park. Little Bit of Soul plays primarily old recordings of jazz, swing, big band, blues, oldies, and Motown.
Tired of the gender binary, gender policing, or just want to speak your truth?
Join CITR's Gender Empowerment Collective,
This group of radio makers is all about centering the voices, issues, concerns, and experiences of women-identified, transgender, intersex, two-spirit, genderqueer, gender non-conforming, non-binary, and gender-fluid folks and allies.
Anyone can join, no experience necessary.
Like the Gender Empowerment Collective on Facebook or email volunteer at citr.ca.
Our show, Babe Waves, airs Thursdays from 5 to 6 and features music, interviews, events, news, commentary, basically anything we care to talk about.
See you then.
Manesh Gurn is a fourth-year cognitive systems student. He is the head of the UBC meditation community. He's been practicing meditation for 6 or 7 years now. Manesh is in the studio today to talk a little bit about the club and what they do. Manesh, thanks so much for coming.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I wanted to start off by just asking, you know, a basic question. A lot of people have these ideas of you know, what meditation is and what it isn't. Can you tell me what you guys are doing with the club? What is meditation for this club?
Yeah, for sure. Well, my personal definition of meditation is how I see it as a way to cultivate a different relationship to your thoughts and to your experience, such that you're able to be more kind of aware and present without getting lost in them. And of course, with our club, what we try to do is provide a space where people can learn how to meditate and learn what it is in a more specific way, because people often have vague notions of what meditation is. It might seem like some really difficult thing that only certain types of people can do. But we just try to provide a space where people can learn different meditation techniques and also have a way to continue it consistently to maintain a practice.
So you have different instructors coming by. You have Zen techniques that are taught. You have mindfulness techniques. Can you tell me a little bit, give me a rundown of all the different styles or techniques that you have coming through?
Yeah, for sure. So on Mondays, we have a teacher doing Vipassana meditation, which you can essentially think of as almost a kind of mindfulness meditation. It's very much centered on being fully aware in the present moment and being aware of your body in particular. And then on Tuesdays, we have a meditation technique called the middle way meditation technique, just from Mahayana Buddhism. And this one's interesting. It involves a bit more visualization and a bit more kind of interesting novel techniques rather than just bare concentration or awareness. So that's Tuesdays. And then Wednesdays, we have Zen meditation. And our teacher is great. He was a monk for multiple decades, a Zen monk, has tons of experience and really knows, you know, the domain very well. So he teaches Zen techniques, which essentially encompass both kind of breath meditation and also just present moment awareness with slightly different emphases from mindfulness and Vipassana. And then Thursdays, we have another Vipassana / mindfulness teacher. And then on Fridays, we have a yoga style meditation. Yes, it's a bit different, a bit more kind of in the body, a bit more movement oriented, but also, you know, very interesting for people who, again, who prefer movement and don't want to just sit there. So
why practice meditation as a group rather than, you know, just sitting at home and learning it yourself?
Yeah, again, like meditation is extremely difficult at the start, especially, and it takes a lot of discipline and persistence to continue with it. So to have this kind of group setting with peers who are also struggling in it together is great for kind of reinforcement and maintaining that motivation. So definitely, I think, especially at the beginning, in a group setting, being in a group setting really helps you kind of get off the ground.
How long are the sessions?
We have the room, well, the session is an hour long, but this is not like an hour straight of meditating. Usually it's about 20 minutes and take a break, then 20 minutes, take a break, interspersed with the teacher saying things about the technique.
I wanted to talk to you a little bit about your personal relationship with meditation. How did you get started doing it?
Yeah, I really started when I was around 16 years old, and it was very much as a way just dealing with mental health, just trying to get rid of any stress or anxiety that I had. And just allowing myself to just kind of escape the maze of my mind and try and just be more present, to kind of detach from that and just come at it from a new perspective. So initially I joined something called Transcendental Meditation, which is essentially, it's like a mantra-based meditation practice where you repeat a word in your head. And I found that made a huge difference in my life and really kind of made me into a more upbeat, positive person, and I just felt a lot more free and aware of what was going on. And this kind of then kind of moved me into being more likely to explore these different other meditation techniques and Eastern traditions, and eventually taking up multiple different styles of meditation.
So that transition from TM to other forms, what was spurring that a little bit? Did you feel that TM wasn't kind of taking you where you wanted to be, or can you explain the thought behind that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed TM, but I was also at the same time very much interested in Zen Buddhism in particular. And obviously they don't really focus on mantra meditation as TM does, so then I was also, you know, I came to the conclusion that, like, you know, these other meditation techniques must also have great validity and helpfulness, so why not also explore and pursue them? And it was also just to have a challenge and try to engage with these more traditional meditation techniques, which might be a bit more difficult to engage with. So almost I saw TM as a platform to engage with these more difficult practices.
And where were you kind of in your life when you started doing meditation? Like, where was your head at?
Yeah, I mean, I was only 16, so this is still in high school. And I just feel like I was not in the best space mentally, and I just felt I could really use something to get a new perspective. So it's more so just kind of breaking out of my regular way of thinking and perceiving myself in the world and trying to see, you know, how else I can operate.
And then when you kind of moved away from TM and you were doing some reading in Zen Buddhism, like what were you getting out of kind of studying meditation as well, kind of not just through practice but through study? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, for me it was a huge overhaul, just my worldview and like who I am and how I am situated in relation to my experiences in my life. And it really, like, I find like a major aspect of meditation is learning how to like not identify with your emotions or thoughts. So essentially it's to allow these emotional experiences to come up or allow these thoughts to come up without being totally engrossed and controlled by them. So I just found that to be like profoundly liberating, as I'm sure anybody else would be. And just like the claims by, you know, Zen meditation teachers, spiritual masters, of their states of like liberation, of being like non-attached and being totally equanimous in all situations was very enticing to me. So,
and where did you find that you could apply meditation in your day-to-day life?
Yeah, it's huge. Like, even now, like,
were there specific scenarios that you?
I feel like it really pervades my entire day. But even in relation to, for example, school or distress or being overwhelmed, it really helps to kind of allow yourself to disconnect a little bit and take a step back rather than being totally lost and all the stuff you need to do, all the stuff that's going on, all the things that are bad and so on. So this gives you a better angle from which to approach just the events and happenings in your life.
You guys are the UBC Meditation Community. What kind of community has grown out of this group?
Yeah, there are a lot of, like, there's definitely a lot of people interested in meditation. So, and like, in one way, this is a way for them to meet other like-minded people. And actually, back in March of last year, I organized and coordinated the UBC Meditation Conference, which was sold out at 100 people. And we had, you know, obviously a great turnout and a lot of cool people and a lot of people making new friends and contacts. So definitely, like, another goal of our club is to bring together people who recognize the value of meditation and just want more of a kind of societal, communal context to engage with such things.
You mentioned before there was some links to meditation and mental health, and you've done some work with mental health groups on campus. Can you describe for me what the benefits are and how we can think about mental health through meditation?
Yeah, I think meditation is great because it really provides a way for you to observe and analyze your thoughts and experiences and reactions and the emotions you go through on a day-to-day basis from almost as if from third person. You kind of just seeing them like, you know, I reacted in this way. I feel these emotions right now. This is how it feels in my body. And really taking a close look at where your mental health is at, where your head is at, where your emotional state typically is. And it's that greater awareness of your mental health is a huge platform for, like, you know, improving it and being aware of your hang-ups and things that get you like off your center.
Now, personally, where is there one place that you're looking in the future that you really want to practice meditation? Is there one specific school or teacher that you'd like to study under? Where do you kind of see it going?